Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you all things Star Wars television. And we are here to talk about The Clone Wars animated series, episode 14 of season 4, A Friend in Need. And joining me today will be Arnie, host of Star Wars Action News.
Always happy to be here for a podcast in need of a fourth host.
Star Wars Fanworks' Nathan P. Butler.
Hello all, also of Star Wars Beyond the Films, over at StarWarsReport.com, brand new show.
And everyone's favorite podcast enhancer, Master Collect 'Em All, Barrent.
Hey, everybody.
And once again, yes, I am Rockstar, and I am back. And what an episode to come back on. The return of the Mandalorians. And Ahsoka gets a step out on her own, but we're going to get to all of that. But before we do, let's go around and get some quick initial thoughts or overall thoughts on this episode. And we'll go around our same order. We'll start with Arnie. Arnie, what did you think of this episode?
I was happily surprised with this episode. When it started, I didn't watch it live. I watched it on my TiVo, and I'd read some positive things online from some of my Facebook friends and things. But when the episode started and I saw everybody lined up and there was a political speech, I was kind of like, here we go again. But within 5 minutes, I felt like this episode really had a ton of kick-butt action and took me back to all the things I really like about Star Wars A New Hope. From the score, to the action, to the excitement, this fit Star Wars to me, and I was really happy about it.
All right, Nathan?
You know, usually I would be one to say that The Clone Wars is the strongest when it does the multi-episode arcs. And generally, if I was looking for the strongest episode of the series, it would have to be some episode from inside one of those arcs, probably the Umbera arc. But I gotta tell you, this episode as essentially a standalone that may tie into other episodes, but isn't in an arc as it's airing, I would never have thought it could possibly wind up in my top five, top three episodes. I would never have thought it could have been one of the best episodes of the series. And it turns out that for a non-arc episode, this is probably the single top episode for me. And it's right up there with even the episodes out of the Umbera arc. It was excellent. It almost flawless, which is terrific.
Wow. High commendation indeed. Barrent?
Yeah, you know, this episode was one of the episodes that Dave Filoni had introduced at Comic-Con with the Clone Wars panel. And he had shown a couple of these scenes with Lux and Ahsoka. And it was in the rendering panel. So, you know, he was kind of introducing it as seeing how, you know, the shading and the different types of characters are going to look and how we've improved this and yada, yada. So when I saw that this episode was coming up, I was not expecting anything exciting or colossal, you know, maybe a good show. But just like you, Arnie, a lot of my friends on Facebook and a couple people from the forums that just texted me and said, oh, man, what a great episode from the East Coast. And just like you, I did not get a chance to see it when it first aired. I watched it on my DVR. But wow, I was so impressed. I was so impressed. You know, Nathan, you said that this was one of your top single episodes of the series, and I have to agree with you.
I'm going to agree with you guys. This was a great episode, and I really didn't expect it to be so. I mean, when I saw the little clip of Lux meeting with the Death Watch, the first thing that went through my mind was, oh, dear Lord, are we really going to go tap dancing into this minefield again? Because we all remember the nerd hate when the Mandos were debuted. That was a bad scene. This, on the other hand, blew me away. It was great. I loved how Lux's plan was handled. I loved the introduction or the reintroduction of the Death Watch, how the tables kind of turned for Lux and Ahsoka. It was really a good episode. I had a lot of fun. There are parts of it that I rewound to watch repeatedly that just I couldn't believe that it was actually happening. So all in all, it was a great episode. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. So let's jump right into it. We started off, as Arnie mentioned, with a meeting between the Republic and the Separatists on Mandalore. And this did kind of give you the, oh my gosh, we're going to get political heebie-jeebies, which we've seen happen in the past and wouldn't have been a surprising turn. But the whole thing is thrown out the window when Lux Bonteri strolls down the aisle to make accusations about Count Dooku. Now, my first thought was, what the crap? He was dead. And I know we've seen the preview that he was alive. We knew that he wasn't dead, but they didn't give us any kind of exposition about he was in hiding or he just strolls right into this meeting and surprise, he's all kinds of not dead. Am I wrong on that? Did they not say that Mina and her son had been killed by the Republic?
I thought they'd only said that Mina was. I don't think they mentioned Lux in it. That it made me forgetting it from back then, but I don't recall them ever saying anything about the fate of Lux whatsoever, because I remember thinking that now he's on his own and at least he's able to show up again after that slight flirtation they built for him and Ahsoka. So if it was mentioned, I must not have caught it the first time, but I don't think it was.
You could be right on that, now that I think about that conversation. It has been a while ago. Forgive me, I'm getting up there in years. But I think you may be right. It may have just been his mother that was said, or his mother that Dooku accused of being killed by the Republic. But Lutz strolls into this meeting and levels these charges against Dooku, and then the Separatists jump up and arrest him. He's drug off by some commando droids who are now apparently standing in for regular battle droids. If, I guess, the last arc in this arc could be believed, I guess those have kind of gone out of use, apparently. He's drugged before a hologram of Count Dooku, which is apparently what he wanted. And just before he's about to be executed, he is rescued by Ahsoka, who was stealthily sent after him by Senator Amidala. This was a little bit interesting. I don't remember. I looked at this the second time I viewed it. I tried to look closely. I didn't see her sabers, so I was kind of confused as to why she went in there hand-to-hand on droids. Did I miss something there? Maybe just the stealth element, I suppose?
It is established in the Clone Wars era here that the Mandalorians are pacifists. And I kind of just took it as no weapons in the peace talks. You know, this is peaceful. It's going to be a peaceful conversation. They really didn't explain it that way, but that's how I kind of took it. You know, no weapons, because as you notice that none of Amidala's Senate guards were actually inside the room at all. You know, and you would think that the senator from the Republic would have some sort of bodyguards with her. But, you know, and speaking of bodyguards, isn't Anakin supposed to be Amidala's bodyguard? You would think that Anakin would be with her when they have to go to these peace talks. But I guess, you know, they have to have Ahsoka because of Lux. But
with regard to the whole bodyguard thing, I just sort of took it as, you know, the person who accompanied Padme in the first place when trying to come up with some kind of way to negotiate with the Separatists was Ahsoka back in Heroes on Both Sides. And it seems like this is dipping back into Heroes on Both Sides, not just for Lux, but you've got the same characters in that Senate session. You've got Vo Attell, voiced by Cat Tabor, a regular. You've got Beck Lawise, the Centene senator, played, of course, by Corey Burton, another regular, which I guess makes it easier to bring them back. And then you add in stuff like bringing back Lux, Jason Spicak. Just constantly, there's all these connections back to specifically Heroes on Both Sides. So I figured if this is a concept introduced in that episode, they would try to make the circumstances as similar as possible, kind of go with what the precedent was the first time there were meant to be these negotiations. To me, Anakin not being there, it didn't seem weird at all at this point.
Yeah, I'm with Nathan. I was kind of able to go with that premise that those two being together kind of got the ball rolling on this whole idea of the Separatists and the Republic meeting. So them being together again worked out.
Well, even just in the sense of always trying to echo previous episodes here, did you notice that the ship that they came in even has that same sort of folding wing design, even though it's a Republic craft, the Phoenix, compared to what we've seen of the Mandalorian ships with the folding down wing design? It seems like they were consciously echoing things rather than just going for continuity. They were going for what I guess Lucas would call the riffs in the music, so to speak, in this case, in the visual style.
I did notice that, and that's a very cool shuttlecraft. I hope that it shows up more so that we get to see a Lego or something of it. But things quickly deteriorate, not only inside the meeting, but outside, with Ahsoka and Lutz being pursued by battle droids and the Senate commandos opening fire. And then they leave, even though the poor senator is still in the middle of this peace talk that has become a war zone. And as they're about to hike her back to Coruscant to maybe offer Lutz amnesty, he stuns Ahsoka and takes the ship somewhere else. That was a little bit... I mean, I can see why they wouldn't want to bring Padme along, but the thought that a Padawan, an R2 unit, and some punk kid just took the whole cruiser that everybody was riding in and took off, that was a little bit odd.
Yeah, there's one logic flaw in the episode. I said it was almost faultless. That's the one that really stood out to me, was the what exactly is Padme supposed to do at this point? You know, she's basically just been stranded. I don't know if such a thing as diplomatic immunity would exist in the context of peace talks, but she better hope that she's not going to be held accountable for anything that Ahsoka just managed to pull off there, when the Separatists realize that the kid they've just taken away to essentially be arrested has now run off with a Republic representative of some kind. Do we even hear from Padme again later in the episode? I forget. I know we hear from Anakin whenever Ahsoka contacts him in the first place, but do we get to find out exactly how Padme got out of there, or if the negotiations are still going on at the time?
No, I never saw Padme again.
Yeah, Padme's kind of left hanging, so to speak. We don't hear from her, and we don't really get to see any conversation. This is kind of jumping ahead, but we don't get to see any closing conversation between Anakin and Ahsoka about what happened. So there's some things left hanging by this episode that could have led to maybe not another full story or more episodes in the arc, but maybe more than one episode. But it'll all get summed up in a newsreel eventually, I'm sure.
You could also say the same thing, I think, for some of the action sequences. The most awesome action moment, of course, I'm sure we'll talk about, with the decapitation of several different Mandos at the same time. That, to me, sort of felt like it was an awesome moment, but at the same time, wow, that's an easy way to take out several people that she would have had to fight, to shorten the amount of fighting, to shorten the amount of action they need to cram into one episode. It seemed like in the process of trying to keep the episode tight, they did cut some of the flab, and maybe some of that flab wasn't quite as unnecessary as some of the rest, like wrapping up with a conversation with Anakin. I don't feel like it suffered from it so much as it was just an odd thing not to try to even make a one-line mention of.
Okay.
One thing that struck me as we were watching is that just like Argaius way, way, way back, we had the Senate Guard captain here, Taggart, who is specifically not a clone, Matthew Wood's voice here. I find it interesting that still they're trying to keep a distinction between the Senate Guards and the clone troopers by not having clones as Senate Guards. You would think with their combat training, it would make sense to eventually bring clones into that group, and yet it still seems like they haven't. Was anybody else surprised that we're not seeing clones integrated there somehow?
Not really, just because I've always thought of the Senate Guards as what will eventually become the Imperial Guards, and we know that they were a little bit more specialized and individualized, at least from various EU materials. So having them not be clones, that doesn't bother me really.
I'm with Dan. I've never thought that they would be clones. They were there before the clones. I can't imagine replacements. I mean, I just picture a whole bunch of Senate Guards out there picketing and unionizing. They took our jobs!
Yeah. Is it better when a machine replaces you or a clone? Which one's the lesser of two evils? So Ahsoka regains consciousness, and we find that the ship has landed on the planet Karlak. She joins Lutz outside after sending R2 to search for her lightsabers, which, once again, when she got tased, she didn't have lightsabers on, and now she's looking for them. Just a minor weirdness there. Not important, because she strolls outside, and in the midst of talking to Lutz, we find out that he is in contact with the Death Watch. Pretty brazen move for a kid, but since he's looking for any kind of revenge against Dooku for his mother's death, understandable.
And not just the Death Watch, they have created a whole new subgroup within the Death Watch for this episode. We now have the Night Owls, led by Katie Sackhoff's character, Bo-Katan, or however you're supposed to pronounce it. So not only are they bringing back the Death Watch in general, they're going to give them, you know, sort of a more distinct look, divide them into groups, the grappling trooper, so to speak, the flamethrower trooper, the way they're described described in the concept art, but they're taking that previously existing group and giving them more depth and more variations than we saw before. Because previously, aside from pre-Vizsla, it seemed like pretty much all the Death Watch Mandalorians we saw were pretty much identical.
And I bring up the San Diego Comic-Con rendering, Star Wars Clone Wars rendering panel, because this was something that the scene where we see the Mandalorians come and land and we get Bo-Katan. In the rendering panel, she was a lot more traditionally Death Watch, like you said, where she was more bluish. Well, Filoni had mentioned, you know, in the scene, she had landed with her hand on her hip. And he had mentioned that he was going to take that out. And true to his word, you know, he took that out. I know that was one of the things I noticed is when she landed, she did not have her left hand on her hip because he did not think that the second in command to Rai Vizsla should be landing like that. He did not want the female characters to have those type of, you know, female dainty traits. And also one of the things I noticed is that her helmet was a lot slimmer and it was white in the middle when it came down to the visor part. And it was not like that in the rendering panel. So he's made some changes within the last few months.
If I can add to this idea of the changing there, something that I wanted to bring up at some point here on the show, just because I think it'd be something our audience would be interested in. We've talked previously about how Dave Filoni will talk about certain aspects of where influences came from for the show, but it seems like every once in a while something will be said that completely contradicts another. One of course, the main characters in this episode is Pre Vizsla, who's got some new parts to his armor and whatnot, but he's sort of known for that trident symbol, that Death Watch symbol that on his helmet has those three spikes sort of coming up from the visor area. And that is a traditional Death Watch symbol, sort of a trident with blades kind of coming up from the top and the bottom. In the recent $15 Star Wars Insider special, which actually is a really good issue and actually kind of worth the money, even though it is kind of a steep price, there is an interview with Dave Filoni about the design of the Mandalorians. It has tons of awesome Mandalorian concept art. At one point, though, talking about that symbol, he says, it's page 132, he says, "We had the old Boba Fett symbol on Pre Vizsla's back, and I said, no, I wanted the Death Watch symbol, the correct symbol. He's fighting for that EU accuracy." But then on the very next page, same interview, he says, "So we simplified it down, we distilled the helmet to its essence, and a trident is always a good symbol. When we did that, we didn't know about the Death Watch logo. I found that one day going through some material and thought, wow, that's a coincidence." So in one interview, Filoni can't seem to figure out whether or not it was something he purposely did to reference the EU or something that was a nice little coincidence, because it doesn't look like both of those stories can be true at the same time. So when we talk about the contradictions inherent in the creative process behind the series, it seems like that is something that we're seeing more and more often. Not that they don't come up with a great product in the end, but it does seem like there is some crossed wires in terms of how the public gets to see these, like what Barrett was saying with the different model in that panel versus what we see finally on television.
Okay. After introducing Ahsoka as his fiance, Lutz and Ahsoka, along with the other Mandalorians and R2-D2, are taken to the Mandalore camp, where we see them using various droids for quote-unquote target practice, and they are taken to see their leader, who is revealed after a slight exposition of his plan between Ahsoka and Lux to be Pre Vizsla, still alive with some new additions to his armor like Nathan talked about, and still just as nasty.
This was not Jon Favreau's voice, right?
No, it was Jon Favreau's voice. It was. And I think he did such a better job. You know, you mentioned that. It was funny because I have that in my notes that it didn't sound like Jon Favreau at first, because I think he really, really tried to make a character out of Pre Vizsla, because in the first incarnation of Pre Vizsla, you could tell it was Jon Favreau. You could close your eyes and you were back in Swingers. But I think this time he put a little bit more gruffness, maybe just a little bit more time, a little bit more acting into it, because there's certain words where you can definitely hear his voice. But I think he did a really great job this time around in trying to make a memorable character out of Pre Vizsla.
There was also no pretense this time around of him starting out as a good guy. the first time we ever saw Pre Vizsla was when he was sort of playing that dual role. He was the leader of Death Watch, but in the very same episode, we had him playing, you know, just the, I am the clean-cut governor of Concordia. I'm going to have a nice diplomatic dinner with Satine, et cetera, et cetera. Here, he doesn't need that pretense of political respectability. He can be the butt kicker. And I think you can sort of see that by the changes to the armor. It's darker. There's more parts to it. It looks more battle scarred as it goes along. And now it's got things that you would think of from the clones, you know, like the different range finders and whatnot. They actually designed his new helmet look purposely to reference the Veritech fighters from Robotech. And those spikes on, I guess they're not rangefinders, one of them maybe, but they are said to be essentially, I guess, helmet cannons. We don't see him use them to shoot, but when you look at the concept art, they say cannons. So, I mean, he's dropped any of this respectable stuff. He's even, in a sense, dropped some of that more honorable style of one-on-one bladed combat, like whenever he fought with Obi-Wan, where it sort of felt like a one-on-one man-to-man honor thing. And now it's, I have all this gear, I'm going to just kill my enemies, and that's how I'm going to win this. He doesn't need the kindness to the voice anymore. I like that Favreau actually let the character's voice evolve while his look was evolving. Otherwise, it might have felt a little bit odd.
And as long as you're talking about the evolution of this character, his mission is more clear stated this time. You know, he wants to kill Dooku. He doesn't like the Jedi. You know, in the, like you said, in the previous incarnation, he was trying to be, you know, he was the governor. So they've really defined what the Death Watch is going to be as they continue into this series.
That begs a question, though, because there were some people asking on forums right after this episode aired, why does he want to kill Dooku? Where did Dooku betray him? And I just figured it was because Dooku wasn't willing to go ahead with the end of the mission back in the original three-part Mandalorian series. I mean, is that what we're all thinking, that betrayal is from, or are we assuming there's some kind of story we haven't seen between then and now? I didn't think there was a missing story, but it seems like a lot of people do.
All right, I actually get to quote Leland Chi for a change to Nathan Butler instead of Nathan quoting Leland to me. According to Leland Chi on his Facebook page, it says that Dooku turned his back on Death Watch years earlier after Death Watch failed to start a civil war on Mandalore and Dooku left Vizsla with a nasty scar on his face.
So basically that's what we saw previously, except without the scar angle? Did he get scarred back in the original three-parter? Because trying to start a civil war and such, that wasn't that what Vizsla was trying to do?
That was one thing that confused me. I remember Dooku wanting Death Watch to start the civil war. Yes. I don't remember at any point where Pre Vizsla got away with a face scar from a lightsaber from Dooku. I'm pretty sure that would have stood out in my mind. But that's what is the fuel behind his fire to hunt down Dooku and return the favor of betrayal that he explains to Lutz. He keeps making reference to this scar. If you betray me, I'll give you one to match. So I would think if you're going to play upon something that heavily, it would have been nice to see it in a previous episode, not just referenced casually. Like maybe he walked away and then forgot something and then came back and gave him the scar. But tragically, that was after the credits had rolled, so we didn't get to see that part.
I do like the fact, though, that by him saying years earlier, that we seem to have at least some confirmation that, unlike what some sites are claiming because of some obscure comic annual released outside the United States, we are talking about this essentially being at least in the last year or so of the Clone Wars, because it can't be years plural and still be set just a year after the prior episodes. Ahsoka is at least a couple of years older here, not just the one, or just a matter of a few months when they made that time jump. So it's nice to see that clarified, even if it was only seemingly in a side accident.
Oh, yeah. And Lutz even seemed older. I mean, he's kind of got that almost facial hair that mid-teenagers get. So obviously he's grown up a little bit more, too. So it obviously didn't happen last week or just 1 year ago. So Ahsoka and R2-D2 are separated from Lutz, who discusses his plan and eventually turns over the information to Pre Vizsla that he's wanting. R2 is taken to the broken droid tent and ordered to repair all their target droids, and Ahsoka finds herself in the woman's tent and there finds out that the Death Watch has been taking prisoners from the local village and enslaving them. And this was the part where it became a little bit odd to me, that the Death Watch was not only this mercenary gun-for-hire group, but that they were taking slaves from the neighboring village because they basically could, was a little bit odd and slightly out of character for noble freedom fighters or even a terrorist group. Later on, I could see where it came into play, where it was essential for the slaughter of the village and to bring Ahsoka out. That just struck me as kind of odd at first.
You know, I felt a little odd about that too, but maybe for a little different reason, because I was more concerned about how they were treating the droids than they were actually treating the human species, the human-like species. So maybe I'm a little odd on that.
I didn't think it was too odd that they would necessarily have people taken as servants, in a sense, these Ming Po, because, you know, we get to see a little bit of their interaction back and forth with Piter or Peter, how are you supposed to say his name, and the little girl Trila. And the few times we actually get to see the Mandalorians interact with those natives before they start killing them off, it seems like it's more like a, you know, fix our dinner, do this, do that. It's more like, you know, we are above that type of stuff. If we can force someone to do the menial stuff, we're the warriors and we're the ones out there waging wars. It almost feels like a very old school, almost pre-classical, you know, barbarians coming back and, woman, where's my dinner type of mindset? Almost like, again, the pretense of any type of respectability is being tossed out the window, and they're just going back to, this is our warrior roots, as Tim Allen would say.
Well, I pose this question to you. Do you think that they used, because one of the captures, one of the slaves that they captured was actually the princess of the village, or, you know, she was the leader's granddaughter.
And we find that out seconds before she gets ganaked. Did.
A little bit shocking. I didn't see that coming.
Oh, wow. Wasn't that? I mean, we're used to seeing, at this point, seeing a character run through isn't that surprising in this show. They kind of broke us into that in the first season. But to see Pre Vizsla pull out his dark saber and run it through this little girl from behind, wow. That was pretty shocking. And yes, we did jump over the part where Grandpa comes to dinner and demands the return of his women, of the village's women. But really, I think this is a point that bears a little bit of discussion, because that was pretty much the beginning of where we really saw the Death Watch just go savage on these people. And in return, Ahsoka kind of got a little savage right back.
I think they definitely made a good choice here in changing things from what they had initially intended to what actually shows up on screen. Because at one point, the villagers were essentially meant to be all Yakorans based on that old Yak face action figure, that species. And I don't think that, as open-minded as the Star Wars audience tends to be, I still think there is an extent to which we will empathize much more with human characters than we do with many alien species. And the less human an alien species seems to be, the less likely we are to be easily empathizing with them. So to change them and try to find something else distinctive, they went for more of an East Asian look here. I mean, they even have the plants being essentially based on Japanese cherry blossoms throughout the landscape. That was a good choice, because I actually kind of felt something for the village as they were being slaughtered, and that Ahsoka really had to do something, kind of rooting for her to please do something before she actually takes action. And I'm not sure that we would have felt the same had this been another non-human yet bipedal species.
Nathan, to clarify the species, I took this species as like the Barriss Offee species, right? They still have the facial tattoos are similar to like Barriss.
It could be, but they are a new, as far as I know, they're a new group. The Ming Po is the way that they're describing them on StarWars.com.
Hmm.
I have to definitely agree with that sentiment, Nathan. As sad a statement as it may be about science fiction fans, we do tend to sympathize a lot more easily with humanoid species. So I think if it had been the slaughter of a Yak Face village, we would have felt less, oh my gosh, what are they doing about it than we did with them being a humanoid species. Now, that all goes out the window if the alien species is some bunch of cute, fuzzy little things, because that all, I mean, if they had been a population of bunnies that talked like Hoojibs, then I think that also would have gotten the what are they doing factor, but Yak faces not so much. So, in the midst of this fight, it is recognized that Ahsoka is a Jedi. And since Pre Vizsla has stated that one of his two goals in life is to kill Jedi, the other one is to kill Dooku, he is going to take this opportunity to extract a portion of his vengeance on Ahsoka. And it is about the time that he is about to do this that R2, who has repaired all the droids, meanders into the tent to cause a disruption, and it all just goes crazy at that point. And Ahsoka starts whipping out some moves that we've been honestly waiting to see a Jedi pull off. It makes me sad that they gave some of the more, I mean, because cutting four people's heads off at the same time, that's a pretty savage move to put in the hands of a teenager. I'm glad to see some Jedi do it. Ahsoka, I guess I can live with it.
Kind of makes the it's treason then moment where Jedi Masters go up against Sidious seem even more weak sauce by comparison.
Well, Sidious was a Sith and the Death Watch were not.
And Ahsoka didn't pretty much stand still either. No, I love the move. I thought that was the one that had me sitting back going, whoa, you know, letting out some excited, good expletives, I suppose, as we were sitting there watching it on screen. It was sort of a tearing thing where it's either the wow, that was awesome, or the wow, that just took care of a bunch of people and shortened that fight just a little bit. But this, again, it's showing Ahsoka coming into her own. We keep talking about how this happens throughout the seasons, that Ahsoka gets to be a character more in her own right. Here, she's on her own. She has her own interpersonal relationship things that are happening. She has her own challenges to face. She overcomes the odds without having a lot of help from the outside. She's even teamed up with R2. A lot of times when we see characters on their own, it's on their own as far as sentience goes, but there is generally a droid companion. So she, in a lot of ways, is now being fit into that mold of a Star Wars hero where she doesn't need all the extra accoutrement to make this work.
And Ahsoka, you know, you're saying that she's coming into her own right. Ahsoka is starting to take on the characteristics of both Anakin and Obi-Wan. She has Obi-Wan's dry wit, where she shows where she's bringing out the food and she tells Lux, you know, I hope you choke on your stupidity. You know, that was something that kind of Obi-Wan would say to someone, you know, kind of keeping it serious but making light of the situation. And she's taking on Anakin's attributes, where she is being a little bit more ruthless when it comes to her enemies, cutting off their heads, throwing a spear through one of the other Mandalorian's bodies that was on the roof, you know, making decisions without having the confidence of someone else, you know, taking that ship with Lux. And she's coming into her own character. She's really starting to grow on me.
Barrett, I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm going back to what Nathan said, I think it was last week on Republic Forces, when he said that Ahsoka started off as a character that I didn't like. And when there were Ahsoka-focused episodes, I wanted to like him. In season one, I really tried to get into him, like the one where she was trapped alone and had to get in the lightsaber fight. But she really grated on me. But the way that by having her character grow up and grow more powerful and stop all the Sky Guy stupidity, she's really grown into a character that I root for as much as I root for Obi-Wan or Anakin or any of the characters from the movie. And to see her here kicking ass, and especially on these people, my reaction to this entire scene was, I was just in rapt attention. I'm like, holy crap, they're burning people on screen. Holy crap, Ahsoka's beheading people. Oh my god, this rocks. Not that it would rock were it real, but it was exciting for fiction.
Oh yes, definitely. This is very much far and away from the initial Ahsoka that we got introduced to. You could not have gotten away with all of a sudden she can do this 4 years ago. Tragically, it's taken 4 seasons for us to get to the point where we could stomach enough of Ahsoka to see this. Well, for most of us. Some people loved her, teenage girls. But,
you know, she's so unapologetic for her actions now. She is really growing into being a Jedi and what her mission in life is supposed to be. It would have been easy to take the route of Ahsoka letting Lux and her love for Lux or her attraction to Lux kind of shape her decisions and how she was going to act and kind of, for lack of a better word, girly about certain things, you know, about whether he was going to approve of some of her decisions. No, that was not in the cards at all. You know, she knew what she wanted to do. She knew that Death Watch was not to be trusted. She never faltered on that, no matter what Lux said to her. And she got the job done. And you can't ask any more from any other Jedi than what she accomplished in this episode.
So Ahsoka and Lutz and R2 manage to get away. They fight off their pursuers one by one, the last of which is Pre Vizsla's lieutenant, Bo-Katan, and they escape. And on their way to hyperspace away from the planet, Ahsoka finds out that the escape pod has been jettisoned. And she goes down and has a little talk through the glass with Lutz. Did anybody expect, because when she started talking, I thought this is where she was going. Did anybody else expect her to kind of go in the we could run away together or the we could keep it a secret conversation about their relationship?
Nope. I think they would have gone too far if they had done that. I mean, they only sort of hinted at the flirtation back in Heroes on Both Sides. Here, and they play it up a bit. It's never anything that seems like it is outwardly spoken. For them to have spoken something to that degree at the end of it, I think would have undermined the flirtation and the way they'd been developing this relationship in general. I mean, you could have something like that, but I think you'd have to have it, you know, a few episodes, a few interactions, more of them at least down the line. People talked about how Anakin was so quick to wind up, you know, falling head over heels for Padme. That kind of rush, especially without any kind of previous experience between the two except for one episode, that's too far.
I think this is the time where I have to disagree with you, Nathan. I think that's exactly what they did. From the time that Lux comes into the room and you can see the reaction from Ahsoka, you could tell right then and there that she has, you know, attraction for him. I mean, it wasn't overly overt. They never said, you know, oh, you look so handsome or, you know, we could run it. But I definitely got that feeling that Ahsoka really thought about running away with him. Because they say, you know, we make a good team and stuff like that. I kind of did get the feeling that this is going to be, I mean, it's obviously this is going to be a blossoming relationship between these two characters. But I think Ahsoka thought about it.
I'm siding with Nathan. I don't think that their relationship's anywhere near that point. Saving his life is one thing. Abandoning the entire Jedi Order that she's worked so hard to become a part of, or keeping it a secret, any of that? Nah, I did not get that from the animation. I did not get that from the lines. I did not get that from the performances. I don't see it at all.
When you put it like that about abandoning the whole Jedi Order, I guess you might be right.
Yeah, that's very true. However, this could be the foundation stones for Ahsoka's eventual exit from the Jedi Order without it being via blaster bolt at the end of Order 66.
How cool would it be to see them wind up going to Lux's home planet? Although there's the chance for continuity disaster, but they have since the previous episode, since Heroes on Both Sides, they have pinned down the homeworld of the Bonteris to Onderon, which is the planet first introduced back in the Tales of the Jedi comics with the Beast Wars and all that kind of stuff and the Freedon Nadd uprising and whatnot. As we haven't seen that a whole lot in recent EU, so it'd be kind of interesting to see what that planet looks like at this point if we were to ever follow both of them or even follow Ahsoka trying to find Lux or something back to the home planets, assuming that choice of Onderon was something that was purposeful by the creative team, not just, hey, let's pull out a random planet name and toss it out there so we've got something to put there for the episode guide on StarWars.com.
Now, there's an interesting similarity because in, I believe it's Knights of the Old Republic 2, isn't that the planet where the Mandalorians are hiding, they're hiding on the moon?
On the Duxan moon, yeah.
Yeah, because the moon comes close enough to the planet that the creatures can fly between. So yeah, that's very interesting that is kind of a similarity or a tie-in to more EU and also probably completely coincidental.
Possibly, but, you know, they dipped into some more stuff here. We don't really have a continuity corner for this episode, but if you look at the Phoenix, the ship that they take, that Republic diplomatic vehicle, that was actually, it was originally a concept art piece back in 1981, but then they turned it into a Lantilian short hauler in the 1988 RPG. Now it's 1988, that's 3 years prior to the official continuity really blossoming with that, the launch of Heir to the Empire and Dark Empire and that sort of thing. So they're dipping back a lot, it seems like, even if it's only for smaller details to bring in here. You got to wonder if that one was picked because it was something that had now an established history as the ship, or if that was something picked just because it was an old concept art piece. Probably the latter, but it'd be cool if it was the former, too. One other thing that pops out here in the episode that we haven't really discussed yet is about the idea of these droids that are set up for battling. We have Battle Droid 513, the hodgepodge droid, according to concept art, that has a leg from a crab droid, an arm from a battle droid, the rest of him is one of those caucus droids. I gotta say, it seems like with these Mandalorian episodes, they have gone out of their way to give us some creepy droid stuff. Back in Voyage of Temptation, we had that creepy spider jumping out of the darkness and whatnot. And here, you know, the greatest tension I felt for any of the characters when surrounded by what appears to be enemies or what appears to be those that could do harm to them, it wasn't Ahsoka and Lux surrounded by the Mandalorians. It was R2 surrounded by all of those fix us, fix us, fix us droids. That was very creepy to me.
I hated that scene. That was the only scene in the entire episode that I didn't like. Because first of all, you got Mando's throwing R2 in there going, fix these droids so we can use them as target practice again. And it's like, okay, so you're being evil because of droids? If they're using droids as target practice, I don't think they'd anthropomorphize the droids to the point that they would care that they're quote-unquote torturing the droids. And then the one going, we are no longer battle droids, we are slaves. It's like, oh, come on, who would program a droid to do that? I did not like that scene at all. The fix us was kind of cool, but the rest of that scene, it was the only scene. I'm like, this episode's so great! Oh my god, that's going to be a crappy subplot. Fortunately, it didn't really go much further.
Yeah, he actually fixed them so they could be targets again. All right, now we did have a few voicemails on this episode, so let's jump right into those.
I just want to say I'm a first-time caller, but a long-time listener. I really enjoy your show. So I'm going to go into my thoughts of a friend in need. I'm of two minds of this episode. I really enjoyed the aspect of the Mandos, but I didn't like the relationship of Lux Bond Terry and Ahsoka Tano. I thought that the Mandos were just really cool. I loved the fight between Vizsla and Ahsoka. And I thought their, like, whole thing, while they're in a new planet now, I just thought that was great. But the Lux Bond Terry and Ahsoka thing, their romance, when they kissed, that was really awkward. And just when the ending scene almost ruined the whole thing. So, really of two minds. I liked, like, the new Mandos, like that woman, which is now part of Death Watch. Hope to see her back. I thought, though, that it should be a two or three episode arc instead of just a one for the Mandos because, like, they are really cool. I loved them in the other ones, and I just think that they should be spread out more. And the new episode looks awesome. It looks like a deserter clone supposedly killing Obi-Wan, but we all know he's not really dead. So thanks for the great podcast, and talk to you next week. Bye.
Well, thank you, Ryan. Thanks for calling in. It's nice, always nice to hear some of our newer listeners leaving a voicemail for us. I'm going to comment on your first point, which was the return of the Mandos. It kind of bleed over into your second point as far as how many episodes. I, too, was very excited to see the return of the Mandalorians, but I was also extremely nervous because the first time it was, I was on the side of the folks who thought it was kind of mishandled. And so I was not very happy with how the Mandalorians came about. This time around, we see them handled a little bit more to my liking. And from what I'm seeing, more of the fans' liking. But I can see why they only wanted to do this for one episode, just in case. It's a safe bet that showing Mandalorians more violent and a little bit more gruff is going to go over well. But as badly as the first three episodes went, doing just one to see how it goes over before you commit to a full arc on that, probably a good call. I'll let somebody else handle that Lux Ahsoka thing. I ain't touching that.
I think I can see where he's coming from in the sense that I was fine with the way that they handled it in this episode. I think if they went very much further with it, it probably would have been going a little bit too far. It probably would have been a little bit overdone. I think we all kind of have a limit to how much we want to see that develop, especially when it's the second time, as far as we know, that the characters have really interacted. I think they did it just enough, but any further, yeah, I think I probably would have been agreeing that it was too much crammed in for the sake of trying to emphasize it to us. That kiss was almost too much. It worked because it was something that was done as a cover. If it had been done as a, you know, oh, we're going off into battle, quick, I must kiss you before we go or we won't get another chance, that would have been too much.
I could kind of see where another Jedi in a relationship or in a possible relationship that is forbidden and it's another forbidden love. And oh, guess what? It's Anakin's Padawan who's having the same kind of issues that he is. I can see where that would get old. So yeah, I can see the Lux Ahsoka thing being kind of overplayed just not necessary because we already see that forbidden love thing going on with Anakin and Padme. But on the other hand, I can see where the appeal of it is too. So on that, I guess I'm of two minds.
You know, I can see how people would not want that storyline introduced, but a lot of storylines are always reintroduced in some way or another. And there was always a lot of complaining on how the Anakin Padme dynamic was handled. And I don't mind so much a love story or a yearning for something that you can't have if it's handled correctly. And I think so far that this Lux and Ahsoka dynamic, this love between them or this blossoming attraction, I think is being handled really well. And another example of the of how Satine and Obi-Wan was handled. So I think both of those situations and scenarios between the characters were handled a lot better and is being handled better than the Padme Anakin situation.
It does seem a little odd, though, for a culture, the Jedi Order, a culture that essentially eschews any kind of attachment and tries not to have these relationships, that in this show are three primary Jedi characters. Every one of them has some form or another of some kind of forbidden attraction, forbidden relationship in their past or nearly relationship. I just rewatched the three-part first Mandalorian arc last night in preparation for talking about this episode, you know, with the whole "I would have left the Jedi Order if you had asked" kind of thing from Obi-Wan. You reach a point where I hope that they handle them differently enough that they all feel unique. Any more Jedi having these relationship attraction type things being introduced into the cartoon, that would be another thing I think would be way too much. We're already kind of pushing it with all three having those type of issues that just happen to be our primary characters in a culture that should not be having these issues.
So on to next.
This is Glenn, Dooku on the forums, calling in about Star Wars, The Clone Wars, A Friend in Need. I really like this episode this week. I think really that it may actually be one of the best standalone episodes that they've done. I don't know, I'd really have to look to compare, but I mean, honestly, I don't think some of them are like better than Rookies, but I think it's really well done. I mean, it worked very well. We had, finally had peace negotiation talks that, I don't know if you would call it ironic, that we almost had last year before Lux's mock got assassinated. It looked like we were going to have talks, and then that broke down. And now we had talks, and then Lux kind of came in and sort of upset that balance. So it's kind of a little bit of, I wouldn't really call that a coincidence. But it's nice to see they actually had, you know, tried to have negotiations. I actually would have liked to see a little bit more of that to try to get a feel of what it is that the separatists want other than to be acknowledged as, you know, other than recognition. That seems kind of, you did a lot more than that. But I really like the Mandalorian stuff. The Death Watch, showing to be very cold, heartless, was great. Really, my biggest complaint with the episode isn't actually anything that, you know, Lucasfilm did, but Cartoon Network. I know a lot of you guys don't watch it live, but, you know, you're watching the show, and I think I sort of knew that this was going to be a standalone, but, you know, halfway through the episode, they give me this preview for the full episode arc where Obi-Wan gets shot next week. And I'm like, wait a second. So, I don't want to know that yet. I don't want to preview, like, in the middle of my episode, no matter what it is. But you're telling me that this, you know, you're sort of making it clear that this episode that I'm seeing now is going to all wrap up in this week. And when you've done a great job of having these sort of multi-episode arcs that you maybe can't tell are going to be a multi-episode arc, I don't want that 15 minutes into the episode. I want to wait till the end. And the preview at the end was much better than the one that they showed in the middle. Although they may have been rather similar, I suspect. And then really the only complaint I have about the episode is that he said, you know, he's quick as an adverb, which it can be, but I would rather use quickly, you know, to go after Count Dooku. But I mean, really, I like that. I think it's a little bit of, irony and, Katie Sackhoff's character, telling Ahsoka she's a little bit thin. I mean, I think she needs to look in the mirror herself. I know you guys have seen a lot of talk about that a couple weeks ago, but, can we not have a stocky female character? I mean, really? I mean, they're either, you know, thin or they're dark, but they're hot. Or I guess she has flat needles. But I mean, seriously, I mean, come on. Let's put some meat on these characters. Let's have somebody out of shape. Even a guy is fat. I mean, come on. Everybody's 50-10 in the show. But, I mean, you know, the movies, you know, you know, a lot of people that weren't in shape, you know, I mean, come on. Let's see some of that in the show. But, that's about it. And, I guess I have a odd arc too. I don't like Obi-Wan being assassinated, but obviously I know he doesn't die, so I'm not that worried. But I would rather see something that is cloned, the Republic against the Separatists, than seeing Bounty Hunters again.
The way they handle these previews sometimes is a little odd. That was one of my quibbles with this episode, too. Not the episode, but Cartoon Network. Not about the preview for next week and when they placed it, which was odd. But I found that they really hyped up Katie Sackhoff coming in as Bo-Katan here when, you know, if we didn't know she was coming back thanks to Dave Filoni in Season 5, I would have felt like that was completely overhyped because pretty much all of her lines or most of her lines showed up in that preview clip that we got months ago thanks to, I guess it was EU or EW.com or whatever it was. Yeah, they do handle the previews a little bit weird for this series from time to time. You almost wonder how much there's coordination between Lucasfilm and the production team and the people actually putting together the advertisements for it. It reminds me of the old thing with Greedo. Yes, we said Greedo, and then Greedo does virtually nothing in the episode.
I did actually watch it on Cartoon Network, not on my TiVo, not live, but on my TiVo, but had the Cartoon Network. And yeah, I found it odd that they put the trailer in the middle, but I didn't mind it. The thing is, I guess I'm a little spoiled going in because with Republic Forces Radio Network, we always try to have the same people on an arc. And so we have to know who's available for how many weeks. And so we're always constantly saying, how many episodes is the next arc? And Nathan had to email me, you know, this isn't an arc. This is an episode. I'm like, what? Not an arc? So I knew going in it was a standalone. The trailer didn't bug me. Yeah, I think we're going to have a recurring theme here from the callers. Obi-Wan, not going to die. Spoiler alert. So it's kind of a silly way to advertise it. But that said, I mean, we always have this case of literary irony, do we not? We know what's happening to the characters. The characters don't know what's going to happen to themselves. And the trick is to find tension in other ways.
Reminds me of about 1997, 1998 going into the prequels. You mean Obi-Wan isn't a three-letter / three-digit, three-character clone designation?
I remember when that was shot around as an idea that Obi-Wan
right the first time.
Hey, Republic Forces Radio Network. This is Ty, TIE Fighter on the forums. I was very disappointed at first. I was thinking, oh, this is going to be another Senate thing or baiting crap. I was just totally down on that. It just turned right around. I was so hyped. I mean, to have Ahsoka go after her friend and save him was cool. But then, you know, to get Death Watch involved, it was just sweet. I mean, Mandalorians everywhere. The female Mandalorians were awesome. And then going in past that, having those droids, I was just so excited to see junked up droids. And first thing my son said when he seen the droids coming after R2, it's like, dude, they're like zombie droids. I was like, yes, sweet. And then, you know, to have him fix them and stuff and make them his friends, it was pretty awesome. But then I loved the land speeders in the show. To have, you know, how Ahsoka was fighting with the Mandalorians. I mean, just the action was way awesome. I mean, to have Ahsoka jump up and slash through like four Mandalorians' heads off at the same time was sweet. But overall, I was very excited about the show. Probably the best show of the season that I can think of. But, love the show. Thanks.
You know, he mentions there the female Mandalorians, and he uses that plural, and I think that's something that slips by a lot of folks on seeing this episode. There were multiple female Mandalorians here, and I initially thought when we saw that, there's a female Mandalorian with, like, short hair. She's in one of the scenes inside, and somebody says something. She kind of turns around past the camera. At first, I thought that was supposed to be Bo-Katan, but if you keep looking in that scene, she still has her helmet on and is standing next to Pre Vizsla. And it turns out that in the same thing where Dave Filoni gave sort of a statement, I guess it popped up on Facebook, where he's talking about the fact that she will come back in Season 5, he also says they purposely left the helmet on Bo-Katan, Katie Sackhoff's character, so that they could make an even more expressive face for her when they do the character models heading into the next season. So yeah, we have multiple female Mandalorians here, and those are very rarely seen. I mean, there are some within the EU and such, but to actually see an emphasis placed on them was kind of neat, and to have multiple ones, even cooler.
I really, really like that idea that they're taking the time to make an awesome head sculpt for lack of a better word, for her, because if they'd just gone with she's Padme's evil twin, that would have sucked so bad. But like we said when we first started this episode, Ty was right there with us. This was such a great fake-out episode. They've done those episodes where they hand us 22 and a half minutes of Senate snooze fest, and to make us think for just a minute, that's what we were going into. I mean, we'd all seen the preview. We knew Death Watch was coming, but if it was going to be 2 minutes Death Watch and 20 minutes of Senate, that would have been just misery. But rather, it was 2 minutes of Senate, if that, and 20 minutes of lots of other fun stuff. So this was a great fake-out episode. This is one where they actually used the reputation that they've given themselves to throw us off the path. I liked it.
Hey, guys. How's it going? This is Devis from the Forum calling in about last night's Clone Wars episode. Where to begin? Well, I know. It was great to see the Mandalorians again, even though, of course, they're not the Mandalorians that some of us are used to. But it was still nice to see, you know, some form of them, and the Death Watch, no less, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but we haven't seen too much of them, I think, except outside the comics, perhaps. But, you know, and they had some great characters. It was nice seeing, was that pre-Vizsla? The one Death Watch, was it too weird antennas on both sides of his helmet? I'm pretty sure that was pre-Vizsla. I mean, he's looking pretty different since we last saw him. It was also nice to see Katie Sackhoff's character of Bo-Katan. She was pretty cool. She's pretty cool. Hopefully we get to see her down the line again. But what they showed us with the Death Watch, like torch in the village, that's from everything that I've read about them and the EU and everything, that's exactly what they would do. I mean, that's pretty much exactly it. But I don't know, maybe this is just something I noticed, but those villagers, they're namely the architecture, it looks like it had a sort of a Japanese oriental feel to it, just the way the buildings looked, namely the roofs, and I mean, I'm sure the rest of the buildings had that feel to it, but I don't know, that's just something I picked up on, and the villagers, I guess they had a Japanese feel to them. But overall, it was a good episode. It had some great visuals, great character models, and all of that kind of stuff. But I guess the question of this voicemail would be, what was the point of this episode? And I mean, I don't mean to take anything away from the episode. It was a great one, like I said. But I mean, I'd originally thought in the beginning of the season that this would be a start of a new arc, and clearly it wasn't. So it just supposed to be Lux and Ahsoka mission? Is this they're hinting at they're going to have a quote unquote relationship down the line? Or I mean, what was the point of this? I don't know. I'll let you guys think that over. And next week, it looks like Obi-Wan's going to get killed. Gasp! I'm going to be on the edge of my seat the entire week to see how that happens. See what plays out. I'm just kidding. We all know what happens with Obi-Wan in the end. But love the podcast, as always. Great to have you guys back. Hope everyone had a great holiday and New Year's. Thanks, guys.
You know, all of the callers has brought up next week's arc. And obviously, Dave Filoni knows that we know that Obi-Wan is not going to die. But I think most people are kind of overlooking the fact that the arc is probably not going to be Obi-Wan getting shot. I mean, that's probably a little point of the plot. But it's going to be focused mainly on the bounty hunters and the main bounty hunter that shoots him, trying to make, quote unquote, make a name for himself. And I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised with what we get. I don't think the focus is going to be too much on like Obi-Wan in the hospital or anything like that. I think it's mainly going to be, you know, on the other characters being introduced.
Credit where due, Dave Filoni probably has nothing to do with any of these ads. It's the Cartoon Network marketing people.
Well, they play up the fact with these episodes, when you look at any of the episode descriptions that have arrived, that Anakin, and this goes along with that preview that we see on StarWars.com, Anakin doesn't know in this next arc about whether Obi-Wan is alive or not. He assumes that he's dead. The whole a big part of this upcoming arc is the idea that Obi-Wan is going to have to keep his survival a secret from everyone, including Anakin. So we have a great opportunity coming up to see the darkness that can come out in Anakin from feeling as though he's lost someone to whom he's very attached, and at the same time give Obi-Wan a chance where he has to operate under the radar. So it is a big plot point, it seems like, but it's a kicking off point for the plot point. You know, it's almost like a lot of these previews we've been seeing where what we see in the preview is maybe somewhere within the first 2 or 3 minutes of the entire episode, and then it's done, like what they had a lot of times with the Umbera arc. It should be an interesting little bit that's coming up. As to the point of why we have this episode, I gotta wonder, as someone who writes, I write professionally, but it's like on the side stuff, not in some large degree, but as someone who writes, there are times where you need to reference back to certain characters, certain events, bring them back up so that they can make sense when they show up later. You don't want to have someone show up at the very beginning, disappear, and then all of a sudden they're the killer in the end of a mystery novel at the end where you hadn't seen them in so long. So I wonder if part of this was just to give us a cool episode, but at the same time, let us see Death Watch again and see where they are. Let us see Lux and bring up the Lux Ahsoka thing again, and let's introduce some other Mandalorian characters like Bo-Katan so that it feels natural when we see them again either later this season or, more importantly, in season 5. Because we hadn't seen Death Watch, at least not Death Watch led by Pre Vizsla. We hadn't seen them since season 2. Yeah, we'd seen the Mandalorians again, but you know, we kind of need that reference back to these people to keep them in play for later. At least that's what I would think they were trying to do.
And even if they're not setting up something later, I mean, realistically, the point is entertainment to me. I don't think everything has to be a domino that needs to fall in a certain way in this series, because I could say, what's the point of this whole series? We had the 6 Star Wars films before we ever knew there was going to be a Clone Wars series, and did we ever feel like, wow, I really wish that outside of the books and the comics we already have in the Gennady Tartakovsky series, that they would spend years telling us more about the skirmishes of the Clone Wars. I don't know that this whole series has a quote-unquote point, because we know how it ends. It's kind of like we were saying with the whole Obi-Wan dying thing. What's the point of trying to say Obi-Wan's going to die when we know he's not? The trick to me with every piece of Star Wars fiction, be it the movies, the series, the books, the comics, to quote Russell Crowe's character from Gladiator, are you not entertained with this episode? I was very entertained, and to me, that's the point.
You know, Arnie, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I've been deep in thought trying to find the deeper meaning behind Bombad General that has kept me awake at night. So I hadn't really put it.
I was consulting Carl Jung, looking for the different archetypes in use in Nomad Droids.
But in all seriousness, yes. If they aren't setting up something in the future, which I could easily see, Lutz has betrayed Death Watch. Death Watch is going to be going after him now. Ahsoka's going to have to save him. Something like that. I could see that easily being set up by this, and now we have some plot behind that. Or if they meet again, they don't like each other, now we know why. Otherwise, this was just a very entertaining one-shot episode to fill the space between a couple big arcs to round out 22 to 25 episodes for the season. Either way, it served a purpose and it works pretty well. And as far as the preview for next week goes, I agree with Baron. I don't think that a big portion of the plot is going to be, Obi-Wan got shot, and is he going to survive? Is he going to survive? I think it's going to be focusing on this bounty hunter making a name for themselves and watching Anakin go right to the brink of being just completely bonkers. So
I would pay money if, instead of it just being Obi-Wan shot and then what happens to him, like he's presumed dead or something, if Obi-Wan got shot and he's sitting on a hospital table and the way they set up him being assumed to be dead or gone is for some droid to turn to Anakin and say he appears to have lost the will to live.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
And just a reminder to listeners, thank you to everyone who left voicemails. Every week, you have until Saturday at midnight in pretty much any time zone, but Saturday night at midnight to leave us a voicemail with your thoughts on that week's episode at 415-508-JEDI.
All right. I want to thank everybody for joining us to listen to our discussion of A Friend in Need. And I want to thank Arnie, Barrent, and Nathan for joining me, and also for no one making a Toy Story reference. This is the part where you say goodnight or goodbye.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night or goodbye.
Talk to you guys later.
And we'll see you all next week.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Barrent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2012, all rights reserved.
Play. Oh, yes, you play. Play.
We need to play just to make it today.
Oh, wow. Busting out the MC Hammer. Wait, how about that voicemail?
My computer appears to have locked up. Let me restart Finder.
Well, I can tell you part of the problem is you're hitting it so hard.
That's what she said.
Right? Oh!